with men who would fight and possibly die beside him. He had viewed battle differently then, as a glorious test of a warrior. "Innocent savagery," he mumbled, listening to the contradiction of the words as he recalled his ignorance in those days so long ago. But his perceptions had undergone a considerable change. Brunner and Drizzt, by becoming his friends and teaching him the intricacies of their world, had personalized the people he had previously looked upon merely as enemies, forcing him to face the brutal consequences of his actions. A bitter bile welled in Wulfgar's throat at the thought of the tribes launching another raid against Ten Towns. Even more repulsive, his proud people were marching to war alongside goblins and giants. As he neared the perimeter, he saw that there was no Hengarot, no ceremonial mead hall in all the camp. A series of small tents, each bearing the respective standards of the tribal kings, comprised the center of the assembly, surrounded by the open campfires of common soldiers. By reviewing the banners, Wulfgar could see that nearly all of the tribes were present, but their combined strength was little more than half the size of the assembly 5 years previous. Drizzt's observations that the barbarians hadn't yet recovered from the massacre on Bryn Shander's slopes rang painfully true. Two guardsmen came out to meet Wulfgar. He had made no attempt to conceal his approach, and now he placed Aegis Fang at his feet and raised his hands to show that his intentions were honorable.
"Who are you that comes unescorted and uninvited to the Council of Hiefstag?" asked one of the guards.
He sized up the stranger, greatly impressed by Wulfgar's obvious strength and by the mighty weapon lying at his feet.
"Surely you are no beggar, noble warrior, yet you are unknown to us."
"I am known to you, Revyak, son of Yorn the Red," Wulfgar replied, recognizing the man as a fellow tribesman.
"I am Wulfgar, son of Beornagar, warrior of the tribe of the Elk. I was lost to you 5 years ago, when we marched upon Ten Towns," he explained,
carefully choosing his phrases to avoid the subject of their defeat. Barbarians did not talk of such unpleasant memories. Revyak studied the young man closely. He had been friends with Beornagar, and he remembered the boy, Wulfgar. He counted the years, comparing the boy's age when he last saw him against the apparent age of this young man. He was soon satisfied that the similarities were more than coincidental.
"Welcome home, young warrior," he said warmly. "You have fared well."
"I have indeed," replied Wulfgar. "I have seen great and wondrous things and learned much wisdom. Many are the tales that I shall tell, but in truth, I have not the time to idly converse. I have come to see Hiefstag."
Revyak nodded and immediately began leading Wulfgar through the rows of fire pits.
"Hiefstag will be glad of your return."
Too quietly to be heard, Wulfgar replied, "Not so glad." A curious crowd gathered around the impressive young warrior as he neared the central tent of the encampment. Revyak went inside to announce Wulfgar to Hiefstag and returned immediately with the king's permission for Wulfgar to enter. Wulfgar hoisted Aegis Fang upon his shoulder, but did not move toward the flap that Revyak held open.
"What I have to say shall be spoken openly and before all the people," he said loudly enough for Hiefstag to hear. "Let Hiefstag come to me."
Confused murmurs sprouted up all about him at these words of challenge, for the rumors that had been running throughout the crowd did not speak of Wulfgar, the son of Beornagar, as a descendant of royal bloodlines. Hiefstag rushed out of the tent. He moved to within a few feet of the challenger, his chest puffed out and his one good eye glaring at Wulfgar. The crowd hushed, expecting the ruthless king to slay the impertinent youth at once. But Wulfgar matched Hiefstag's dangerous stare and did not back away an inch.
"I am Wulfgar," he proclaimed proudly, "son of Beornagar, son of Beorn before him, warrior of the tribe of the Elk, who fought at the Battle of Bryn Shander, wielder of Aegis Fang, the giant foe."
He held the great hammer high before him.
friend to dwarven craftsman and student to arranger of Gueron Winstrom, giant killer and lair invader, slayer of the frost giant chieftain Bigrin.
He paused for a moment, his eyes squinted by a spreading smile, heightening the anticipation of his next proclamation. When he was satisfied that he held the crowd's fullest attention, he continued,
I am Wulfgar, Dragonsbane.
Heathstag flinched. No living man on all the tundra had claim to such a lofty title.
I claim the right of challenge,
Wulfgar growled in a low, threatening tone.
I shall kill you,
Heathstag replied with as much calm as he could muster. He feared no man, but was wary of Wulfgar's huge shoulders and corded muscles. The king had no intention of risking his position at this time, on the brink of an apparent victory over the fishermen of Ten Towns. If he could discredit the young warrior, then the people would never allow such a fight. They would force Wulfgar to relinquish his claim, or they would kill him at once.
By what birthright do you make such a claim? You would lead our people at the beckon of a wizard, Wulfgar retorted.
He listened closely to the sounds of the crowd to measure their approval or disapproval of his accusation.
You would have them raise their swords in a common cause with goblins and orcs.
No one dared protest aloud, but Wulfgar could sense that many of the other warriors were secretly enraged about the coming battle. That would explain the absence of the Mead Hall as well, for Heathstag was wise enough to realize that simmering anger often exploded in the high emotions of such a celebration. Revyak interposed before Heathstag could reply with words or with weapon.
Son of Beornagar, Revyak said firmly, you have as yet earned no right to question the orders of the king. You have declared an open challenge. The rules of tradition demand that you justify, by blood or by deed, your right to such a fight.
Excitement revealed itself in Revyak's words, and Wulfgar knew immediately that his father's old friend had intervened to prevent the start of an unrecognized and therefore unofficial brawl. The older man obviously had faith that the impressive young warrior could comply with the demands. And Wulfgar further sensed that Revyak, and perhaps many others, hoped the challenge would be successfully carried through. Wulfgar straightened his shoulders and grinned confidently at his opponent, gaining strength in the continuing proof that his people were following Heathstag's ignoble course simply because they were bound to the One-Eyed King and could produce no suitable challengers to defeat him.
By deed, he said evenly.
Without releasing Heathstag from his stare, Wulfgar unstrapped the rolled blanket he carried on his back and produced two spear-like objects. He tossed them casually to the ground before the king. Those in the crowd who could clearly see the spectacle gasped in unison, and even unshakable Heathstag paled and rocked back a step.
The challenge cannot be denied, cried Revyak.
The Horns of Icing Death. The cold sweat on Heathstag's face revealed his tension as he buffed the last burrs from the head of his huge axe.
Dragonsbane, he huffed unconvincingly to his standard-bearer, who had just entered the tent. More likely that he stumbled upon a sleeping worm.
Your pardon, mighty king, the young man said. Revyak has sent me to tell you that the appointed time is upon us.
Good,
sneered Heathstag, running his thumb across the shining edge of the axe.
I shall teach the son of Beornagar to respect his king.
The warriors from the tribe of the Elk formed a circle around the combatants. Though this was a private event for Heathstag's people, the other tribes watched with interest from a respectable distance. The winner would hold no formal authority over them, but he would be the king of the most powerful and dominant tribe on the tundra. Revyak stepped within the circle and moved between the two opponents.
I proclaim Heathstag, he cried, king of the tribe of the Elk.
He went on to read the One-Eyed King's long list of heroic deeds. Heathstag's confidence seemed to return during the reciting. Though he was a bit confused and angry that Revyak had chosen to proclaim him first. He placed his hands on his wide hips and glared around threateningly at the closest onlookers, smiling as they backed away from him one by one. He did the same to his opponent, but again his bullying tactics failed to intimidate Wulfgar.
"And I proclaim Wulfgar," Revyak continued, "son of Beornagar and challenger to the throne of the tribe of the Elk."
The reciting of Wulfgar's list took much less time than Hiefstag's, of course. But the final deed that Revyak proclaimed brought a degree of parity to the two.
"Dragonsbane!"
Revyak cried, and the crowd, respectfully silent up to this point, excitedly began recounting the numerous rumors that had begun concerning Wulfgar's slaying of Isingdeath. Revyak looked to the two combatants and stepped out of the circle. The moment of honor was upon them. They waited around the circle of battle, cautiously stalking and measuring each other for hints of weakness. Wulfgar noted the impatience on Hiefstag's face, a common flaw among barbarian warriors. He would have been much the same were it not for the blunt lessons of Drizzt Do'Urden. 1,000 humiliating slaps from the drow's scimitars had taught Wulfgar that the first blow was not nearly as important as the last. Finally, Hiefstag snorted and roared in. Wulfgar also growled aloud, moving as if he would meet the charge head-on. But then he sidestepped at the last moment, and Hiefstag, pulled by the momentum of his heavy weapon, stumbled past his foe and into the first rank of onlookers. The one-eyed king recovered quickly and charged back out, doubly enraged, or so Wulfgar believed. Hiefstag had been king for many years and had fought in countless battles. If he had never learned to adjust his fighting technique, he would have long ago been slain. He came at Wulfgar again, by all appearances more out of control than the first time. But when Wulfgar moved out of the path, he found Hiefstag's great axe waiting for him. The one-eyed king, anticipating the dodge, swung his weapon sideways, gashing Wulfgar's arm from shoulder to elbow. Wulfgar reacted quickly, thrusting Aegis Fang out defensively to deter any follow-up attacks. He had little weight behind his swing, but its aim was true, and the powerful hammer knocked Hiefstag back a step. Wulfgar took a moment to examine the blood on his arm. He could continue to fight.
"You parry well,"
Hiefstag growled as he squared off just a few steps from his challenger.
"You would have served our people well in the ranks. A loss it is that I must kill you."
Again the axe arced in, raining blow after blow in a furious assault meant to end the fight quickly. But compared to the whirring blades of Drizzt Do'Urden, Hiefstag's axe seemed to move sluggishly. Wulfgar had no trouble deflecting the attacks, even countering now and then with a measured jab that thudded into Hiefstag's broad chest. Blood of frustration and weariness reddened the one-eyed king's face. "A tiring opponent will often move with all of his strength at once," Drizzt had explained to Wulfgar during the 10 days of training. "But rarely will he move in the apparent direction, the direction that he thinks you think he is moving in." Wulfgar watched intently for the expected feint. Resigned that he could not break through the skilled defenses of his younger and faster foe, the sweating king brought the great axe up over his head and lunged forward, yelling wildly to emphasize the attack. But Wulfgar's reflexes were honed to their finest fighting edge, and the overemphasis that Hiefstag placed upon the attack told him to expect a change in direction. He raised Aegis Fang as if to block the feigned blow, but reversed his grip even as the axe dropped down off Hiefstag's shoulder and came in deceptively low in a sidelong swipe. Trusting fully in his dwarven-crafted weapon, Wulfgar shifted his front foot back, turning to meet the oncoming blade with a similarly angled cut from Aegis Fang. The heads of the two weapons slammed together with incredible force. Hiefstag's axe shattered in his hands, and the violent vibrations knocked him backward to the ground. Aegis Fang was unharmed. Wulfgar could have easily walked over and finished Hiefstag with a single blow. Revyak clenched his fist in anticipation of Wulfgar's imminent victory. "Never confuse honor with stupidity," Drizzt had scolded Wulfgar after his dangerous inaction with the dragon. But Wulfgar wanted more from this battle than to simply win the leadership of his tribe. He wanted to leave a lasting impression on all of the witnesses. He dropped Aegis Fang to the ground and approached Heafstog on even terms. The barbarian king didn't question his good fortune. He sprang at Wulfgar, wrapping his arms about the younger man in an attempt to drive him backward to the ground. Wulfgar leaned forward to meet the attack, planting his mighty legs firmly, and stopped the heavier man in his tracks. They grappled viciously, exchanging heavy blows before managing to lock each other close enough to render punches ineffective. Both combatants' eyes were blue and puffy, bruises and cuts welled on face and chest alike. Heafstog was the wearier, though, his barrel chest heaving with each labored breath. He wrapped his arms around Wulfgar's waist and tried again to twist his relentless opponent to the ground. Then Wulfgar's long fingers locked onto the sides of Heafstog's head. The younger man's knuckles whitened, the huge muscles in his forearms and shoulders tightened. He began to squeeze. Heafstog knew at once that he was in trouble, for Wulfgar's grip was mightier than a white bear's. The king struggled wildly, his huge fists slugging into Wulfgar's exposed ribs, hoping only to break Wulfgar's deadly concentration. This time, one of Brunner's lessons spurred him on.
"Think of the weasel, boy. Take the minor hits, but never, never let him go once you're on."
His neck and shoulder muscles bulged as he drove the one-eyed king to his knees. Horrified at the power of the grip, Heafstog pulled at the younger man's iron-hard forearms, trying vainly to relieve the growing pressure. Wulfgar realized that he was about to kill one of his own tribe.
"Yield!" he shouted at Heafstog, seeking some more acceptable alternative. The proud king answered with a final punch. Wulfgar turned his eyes to the sky. "I am not like him," he yelled helplessly, vindicating himself to any who would listen. But there was only one path left open to him. The young barbarian's huge shoulders reddened as the blood surged through them. He saw the terror in Heafstog's eye transcend into incomprehension. He heard the crack of bone. He felt the skull squash between his mighty hands. Revyak should then have stepped into the circle and heralded the new king of the tribe of the Elk. But like the other witnesses around him, he stood unblinking, his jaw hanging open. Helped by the gusts of the cold wind at his back, Drizzt sped across the last miles to Ten Towns. On the same night that he had split from Wulfgar, the snow-capped tip of Kelvin's Cairn came into view. The sight of his home drove the drow onward even faster, yet a nagging hint on the edge of his senses told him that something was out of the ordinary. A human eye could never have caught it, but the keen night vision of the drow finally sorted it out. A growing pillar of blackness, blotting out the horizon's lowest stars south of the mountain, and a second, smaller column south of the first. Drizzt stopped short. He squinted his eyes to be sure of his guess. Then he started again, slowly, needing the time to sort through an alternate route that he could take. Caer Conic and Caer Dinevo were burning. 23. Besieged. Caer Dinevo's fleet trolled the southernmost waters of Lac Dinashir, taking advantage of the areas left open when the people of Easthaven fled to Bryn Shander. Caer Conig's ships were fishing their familiar grounds by the lake's northern banks. They were the first to see the coming doom. Like an angry swarm of bees, Kessel's foul army swept right around the northern bend of Lac Dinashir and roared down Icewind Pass. "Up anchor!"
cried Shermont and many other ships' captains as soon as they had recovered from the initial shock. But they knew even then that they could not get back in time. The leading arm of the goblin army tore into Caer Conic. The men on the boat saw the flames leap up as buildings were put to the torch. They heard the blood-crazed hoots of the vile invaders. They heard the dying screams of their kin. The women, children, and old men who were in Caer Conic had no thoughts of resistance. They ran, for their lives they ran. And the goblins chased them and cut them down. Giants and ogres rushed down to the docks, squashing the pitiful humans who beckoned helplessly to the returning fleet, or forcing them into the cold death of the lake's waters. The giants carried huge sacks, and as the brave fishermen rushed into port, their vessels were pummeled and crippled by hurled boulders. Goblins continued to flow into the doomed city, yet the bulk of the vast army's trailing edge flowed past and continued on toward the second town, Caer Dinnaval. By this time, the people in Caer Dinnaval had seen the smoke and heard the screams and were already in full flight to Bryn Shander, or out on the docks begging their sailors to come home. The Caer Dinnaval's fleet, though they caught the strength of the east wind in their rush back across the lake, had miles of water before them. The fishermen saw the pillars of smoke growing over Caer Conic, and many suspected what was happening and understood that their flight, even with their sails so full of wind, would be in vain. Still, groans of shock and disbelief could be heard on every deck when the black cloud began its ominous climb from the northernmost sections of Caer Dinnaval. Then Shermont made a gallant decision. Accepting that his own town was doomed, he offered his help to his neighbors.
"We cannot get in," he cried to a captain of a nearby ship. "Pass the word! Away south! Dinnaval's docks are yet clear!"
From a parapet on Bryn Shander's wall, Regis, Cassius, Agorwal, and Glensather watched in horror as the wicked force flowed down the stretch away from the two sacked cities, gaining on the fleeing people of Caer Dinnaval.
"Open the gates, Cassius," Agorwal cried. "We must go out to them. They have no chance of gaining the city unless we slow the pursuit."
"Nay," replied Cassius somberly, painfully aware of his greater responsibilities. "Every man is needed to defend the city. To go out onto the open plain against such overwhelming numbers would be futile. The towns on Lac Dinnershire are doomed."
"They are helpless," Agorwal shot back. "Who are we if we cannot defend our kinfolk? What right do we have to stand watching from behind this wall while our people are slaughtered?"
Cassius shook his head, resolute in his decision to protect Bryn Shander. But then other refugees came running down the second pass, Bremen's Run, fleeing the open town of Termalane in their hysteria when they saw the cities across the way put to the torch. More than 1,000 refugees were now within sight of Bryn Shander. Judging their speed and the distance remaining, Cassius estimated that they would converge on the wide field just below the principal city's northern gates, where the goblins would catch them.
"Go," he told Agorwal.
Bryn Shander couldn't spare the men, but the field would soon run red with the blood of women and children. Agorwal led his valiant men down the northeastern road in search of a defensible position where they could dig in. They chose a small ridge, actually more like a crest where the road dipped slightly. Entrenched and ready to fight and die, they waited as the last of the refugees ran past, terrified, screaming, because they believed they had no chance of reaching the safety of the city before the goblins descended upon them. Smelling human blood, the fastest runners of the invading army were right behind the trailing people, mostly mothers clutching their babies. Intent on their easy victims, the lead monsters never even noticed Agorwal's force until the waiting warriors were upon them. By then, it was too late. The brave men of Termalane caught the goblins in a crossfire of arrows and then followed Agorwal into a fierce sword rush. They fought fearlessly, as men who had accepted what fate had dealt them. Dozens of monsters lay dead in their tracks, and more fell with each passing minute as the enraged warriors pressed into their ranks. But the line seemed endless. As one goblin fell, two replaced it. The men of Termalane were soon engulfed in a sea of goblins. Agorwal gained a high point and looked back toward the city. The fleeing women were a good distance across the field, but moving slowly. If his men broke their ranks and fled, they would overtake the refugees before the slopes of Bryn Shander, and the monsters would be right behind.
"We must go out and support Agorwal,"
Glensather yelled at Cassius. But this time the spokesman from Bryn Shander remained resolute. "Agorwal has accomplished his mission," Cassius responded. "The refugees will make the wall. I'll not send more men out to die. Even if the combined strength of all of 10 towns were on the field, it would not be able to defeat the foe before us." Already the wise spokesman understood that they could not fight Kessel on even terms. The kindly Glensather looked crestfallen.
"Take some troops down the hill," Cassius conceded. "Help the exhausted refugees up the final climb."
Agorwal's men were hard-pressed now.
The spokesman from Tourmaline looked back again and was appeased. The women and children were safe. He scanned up to the high wall, aware that Regis, Cassius, and the others could see him, a solitary figure on the small rise, though he could not pick them out among the throng of spectators that lined Bryn Shander's parapets. More goblins poured into the fray, now joined by ogres and Verbeeg. Agorwal saluted his friends in the city. His contented smile was sincere as he spun around and charged back down the grade to join his victorious troops in their finest moment. Then Regis and Cassius watched the black tide roll over every one of the brave men of Tourmaline. Below them, the heavy gate slammed shut. The last of the refugees were in. While Agorwal's men had won a victory of honor, the only force that actually battled Kessel's army that day and survived were the dwarves. The clan from Mithril Hall had spent days in industrious preparation for this invasion, yet it nearly passed them by altogether. Held by the wizard's compelling will into discipline unheard of among goblins, especially varied and rival tribes, Kessel's army had definite and direct plans for what they had to accomplish in the initial surge. As of this point, the dwarves were not included. But Brunner's boys had other plans. They weren't about to bury themselves in their mines without getting to lop off at least a few goblin heads, or without crushing the kneecaps of a giant or two. Several of the bearded folk climbed to the southern tip of their valley. When the trailing edge of the evil army flowed past, the dwarves began to taunt them, shouting challenges and curses against their mothers. The insults weren't even necessary. Orcs and goblins despised dwarves more than anything else alive, and Kessel's straightforward plan flew from their minds at the mere sight of Brunner and his kin. Ever hungry for dwarven blood, a substantial force broke away from the main army. The dwarves let them close in, goading them with taunts until the monsters were nearly upon them. Then Brunner and his kin slipped back over the rocky ledge and down the steep drop.
"Come and play, stupid dogs!"
Brunner chuckled wickedly as he disappeared from sight. He pulled a rope off of his back. There was one little trick he had thought up that he was anxious to try out. The goblins charged into the rocky vale, outnumbering the dwarves 4-1, and they were backed by a score of raging ogres. The monsters didn't have a chance. The dwarves continued to coax them on, down the steepest part of the valley, to the narrow, sloping ledges on the cliff face that crossed in front of the numerous entrances to the dwarven caves. An obvious place for an ambush, but the stupid goblins, frenzied at the sight of their most hated enemies, came on anyway, heedless of the danger. When the majority of the monsters were on the ledges and the rest were making the initial descent into the vale, the first trap was sprung. Catti Bree, heavily armed but positioned in the back of the inner tunnels, pulled a lever, dropping a post on the vale's upper crest. Tons of rocks and gravel tumbled down upon the tail of the monster's line, and those who managed to keep their precarious balance and escape the brunt of the avalanche found the trails behind them buried and closed to any escape. Crossbows twanged from concealed nooks, and a group of dwarves rushed out to meet the lead goblins. Brunner wasn't with them. He had hidden himself further back on the trail and watched as the goblins, intent on the challenge up ahead, passed him by. He could have struck then, but he was after larger prey, waiting for the ogres to come into range. The rope had already been carefully measured and tied off. He slipped one of its looped ends around his waist and the other securely over a rock, then pulled two throwing axes from his belt. It was a risky ploy, perhaps the most dangerous the dwarf had ever tried, but the sheer thrill of it became obvious in the form of a wide grin across Brunner's face when he heard the lumbering ogres approaching. He could hardly contain his laughter when two of them crossed before him on the narrow trail. Leaping from his concealment, Brunner charged at the surprised ogres and threw the axes at their heads. The ogres twisted and managed to deflect the half-hearted throws, but the hurled weapons were merely a diversion. Brunner's body was the true weapon in this attack. Surprised and dodging from the axes, the two ogres were put off balance. The plan was falling into place perfectly. The ogres could hardly find their footing. Twitching the powerful muscles in his stubby legs, Brunner launched himself into the air, crashing into the closest monster. It fell with him onto the other, and they tumbled all three over the edge. One of the ogres managed to lock its huge hand onto the dwarf's face, but Brunner promptly bit it, and the monster recoiled. For a moment they were a falling jumble of flailing legs and arms, but then Brunner's rope reached its length and sorted them out.
"Have a nice landing, boys," Brunner called as he broke free of the fall. "Give the rocks a big kiss for me."
The backswing on the rope dropped Brunner into the entrance of a mine shaft on the next lowest ledge as his helpless victims dropped to their deaths. Several goblins in line behind the ogres had watched the spectacle in blank amazement. Now they recognized the opportunity of using the hanging cord as a shortcut to one of the caves, and one by one they climbed onto the rope and started down. But Brunner had anticipated this as well. The descending goblins couldn't understand why the rope felt so slick in their hands. When Brunner appeared on the lower ledge, the end of the rope in one hand and a lighted torch in the other, they figured it out. Flames leaped up the oiled twine. The topmost goblin managed to scramble back on the ledge. The rest took the same route as the unfortunate ogres before them. One nearly escaped the fatal fall, landing heavily on the lower ledge. Before he could even regain his feet, though, Brunner kicked him over. The dwarf nodded approvingly as he admired the successful results of his handiwork. That was one trick he intended to remember. He slapped his hands together and darted back down the shaft. It sloped upward farther back to join the higher tunnels. On the upper ledge, the dwarves were fighting a retreating action. Their plan was not to clash in a death fight outside, but to lure the monsters into the entrances of the tunnels. With the desire to kill blotting out any semblance of reason, the dim-witted invaders readily complied, assuming that their greater numbers were pushing the dwarves back into a corner. Soon tunnels rang out with a clash of sword on sword. The dwarves continued to back away, leading the monsters completely into the final trap. Then, from somewhere deeper in the caves, a horn sounded. On cue, the dwarves broke away from the melee and fled down the tunnels. The goblins and ogres, thinking that they had routed their enemies, paused only to whoop out victory cries, then surged after the dwarves. But deeper in the tunnels, several levers were pulled. The final trap was sprung, and all of the tunnel entrances simply collapsed. The ground shook violently under the weight of the rock drop. The entire face of the cliff came crashing down. The only monsters that survived were the ones at the very front of the lines. And disoriented, battered by the force of the drop and dizzied by the blast of dust, they were immediately cut down by the waiting dwarves. Even the people as far away as Bryn Shander were shaken by the tremendous avalanche. They flocked to the north wall to watch the rising cloud of dust, dismayed, for they believed that the dwarves had been destroyed. Regis knew better. The halfling envied the dwarves, safely entombed in their long tunnels. He had realized the moment he saw the fires rising from Kaer Konig that his delay in the city, waiting for his friend from Lonelywood, had cost him his chance to escape. Now he watched, helplessly and hopelessly, as the black mass advanced toward Bryn Shander. The fleets on Mare de Walden and Redwaters had put back to their home ports as soon as they realized what was happening. They found their family safe for the present time, except for the fishermen of Termalane who sailed into a deserted town. All that the men of Termalane could do, as they reluctantly put back out to sea, was hope that their kin had made it to Bryn Shander or some other sanctuary. For they saw the northern flank of Kessel's army swarming across the field toward their doomed city. Targos, the second strongest city, and the only one other than Bryn Shander with any hope of holding out for any length of time against the vast army, extended an invitation for Termalane's ships to tie up at her docks. And the men of Termalane, soon to be numbered among the homeless themselves, accepted the hospitality of their bitter enemies to the south. Their disputes with Kemp's people seemed petty indeed, against the weight of the disaster that had befallen the towns. Back in the main battle, the goblin generals that led Kessel's army were confident they could overrun Bryn Shander before nightfall. They obeyed their leader's plan to the letter. The main body of the army veered away from Bryn Shander and moved down the swath of open ground between the principal city and Targus, thus cutting any possibility of the two powerful cities linking their forces. Several of the goblin tribes had broken away from the main group and were bearing down on Termalane, intent on sacking their third city of the day. But when they found the place deserted, they abstained from burning the buildings. part of Kessel's army now had a ready-made camp where they could wait out the coming siege in comfort. Like two great arms, thousands of monsters raced south from the main force. So vast was Kessel's army that it filled the miles of field between Bryn Shander and Tourmaline, and still had enough numbers to encircle the hill of the principal city with thick ranks of troops. Everything had happened so quickly that when the goblins finally stalled their frenzied charge, the change seemed overly dramatic. After a few minutes of breath-catching calm, Regis felt the tension growing once again.
"Why don't they just get it over with?"
he asked the two spokesmen standing beside him. Cassius and Glenn Sather, more knowledgeable in the ways of warfare, understood exactly what was happening.
"They are in no hurry, little friend," Cassius explained. "Time favors them."
Then Regis understood. During his many years in the more populated Southlands, he had heard many vivid tales describing the terrible horrors of a siege. The image of a Gorwell's final salute out in the distance came back to him then, the contented look on the spokesman's face, and his willingness to die valiantly. Regis had no desire to die in any way, but he could imagine what lay before him and the cornered people of Bryn Shander. He found himself envying a Gorwell. 24. Kryshel Tirith. Drizzt soon came upon the battered ground where the army had crossed. The tracks came as no surprise to the drow, for the smoke pillars had already told him much of what had transpired. His only remaining question was whether or not any of the towns had held out, and he trotted on toward the mountain, wondering if he had a home to return to. Then he sensed a presence, an otherworldly aura that strangely reminded him of the days of his youth. He bent to check the ground again. Some of the marks were fresh troll tracks and a scarring on the ground that could not have been caused by any mortal being. Drizzt looked around nervously, but the only sound was the mourn of the wind, and the only silhouettes on the horizons were the peaks of Kelvin's cairn before him and the spine of the world far to the south. Drizzt paused to consider the presence for a few moments, trying to bring the familiarity he felt into better focus. He moved on tentatively. He understood the source of his recollections now, though their exact details remained elusive. He knew what he was following. A demon had come to Icewind Dale. Kelvin's cairn loomed much larger before Drizzt caught up to the band. His sensitivity to creatures of the lower planes, brought about by centuries of associating with them in Menzo Berenzon, told him that he was nearing the demon before it came into sight. And then he saw the distant forms, a half-dozen trolls marching in a tight rank, and in their midst, towering over them, was a huge monster of the abyss. No minor mane or midge, Drizzt knew at once, but a major demon. Kessel must be mighty indeed if he held this formidable monster under his control. Drizzt followed them at a cautious distance. The band was intent on their destination, though, and his caution was unnecessary. But Drizzt wasn't about to take any chances at all, for he had many times witnessed the wrath of such demons. They were commonplace in the cities of the Drow, further proof to Drizzt O'Urden that the ways of his people were not for him. He moved in closer, for something else had grabbed his attention. The demon was holding a small object which radiated such powerful magic that the drow, even at this distance, could sense it clearly. It was too masked by the demon's own emanations for Drizzt to get any clear perspectives on it, so he backed off cautiously once again. The lights of thousands of campfires came into view as the party and Drizzt approached the mountain. The goblins had set scouts in this very area, and Drizzt realized that he had gone as far south as he could. He broke off his pursuit and headed for the better vantage points up the mountain. The time best suited to the drow's underworld vision was the lightning hours just before sunrise, and though he was tired, Drizzt was determined to be in position by then. He quickly climbed up the rocks, gradually working his way around to the southern face of the mountain.
Then he saw the campfires encircling Bryn Shander. Further to the east, embers glowed in the rubble that had been Kaer Konig and Kaer Dinaval. Wild shouts rang out from Termalane, and Drizzt knew that the city on Mare Dualden was in the hands of the enemy. And then, pre-dawn blew the night sky, and much more became apparent. Drizzt first looked to the south end of the Dwarven Valley, and was comforted that the wall opposite him had collapsed. Brunner's people were safe at least, and Regis with them, the drow supposed. But the sight of Bryn Shander was less comforting. Drizzt had heard the boasts of the captured orc, and had seen the tracks of the army and their campfires, but he could never have imagined the vast assemblage that opened up before him when the light increased. The sight staggered him. "How many goblin tribes have you collected, Akar Kessel?" he gasped. "And how many of the giants call you master?" He knew that the people in Bryn Shander would survive only as long as Kessel let them. They could not hope to hold out against this force. Dismayed, he turned to seek out a hole where he could get some rest. He could be of no immediate help here, and exhaustion was heightening his hopelessness, preventing him from thinking constructively. As he started away from the mountain face, sudden activity on the distant field caught his attention. He couldn't make out individuals at this great distance. The army seemed just a black mass, but he knew that the demon had come forth. He saw the blacker spot of its evil presence wade out to a cleared area only a few hundred yards below the gates of Bryn Shander. And he felt the supernatural aura of the powerful magic he had earlier sensed, like the living heart of some unknown life form pulsating in the demon's clawed hands. Goblins gathered around to watch the spectacle, keeping a respectable distance between them and Kessel's dangerously unpredictable captain.
"What is that?"
asked Regis, crushed in among the watching throng on Bryn Shander's wall.
"A demon," Cassius answered. "A big one."
"It mocks our meager defenses," Glenn Sather cried. "How can we hope to stand against such a foe?"
The demon bent low, involved in the ritual to call out the Dwyamer of the crystalline object. It stood the crystal shard upright on the grass and stepped back, bellowing forth the obscure words of an ancient spell, rising to a crescendo as the sky began to brighten with the sun's imminent appearance.
"A glass dagger?"
Regis asked, puzzled by the pulsating object. Then the first ray of dawn broke the horizon. The crystal sparkled and summoned the light, bending the sunbeam's path and absorbing its energy. The shard flared again, the pulsations intensified as more of the sun crept into the eastern sky, only to have its light sucked into the hungry image of Kren Shinabon. The spectators on the wall gaped in horror, wondering if Akar Kessel held power over the sun itself. Only Cassius had the presence of mind to connect the power of the shard with the light of the sun. Then the crystal began to grow. It swelled as each pulse attained its peak, then shrank back a bit while the next throb grew. Everything around it remained in shadow, for it greedily consumed all the sunlight. Slowly, but inevitably, its girth widened, and its tip rose high into the air. The people on the wall and the monsters on the field had to avert their eyes from the brightened power of Kryshal Tirith. Only the drow from his distant vantage point, and the demon, who was immune to such sights, witnessed another image of Kren Shinabon being raised. The third Kryshal Tirith grew to life. The tower released its hold on the sun as the ritual was completed, and all the region was bathed in morning sunlight. The demon roared at its successful spellcasting and strode proudly into the new tower's mirrored doorway, followed by the trolls, the wizard's personal guard. The besieged inhabitants of Bryn Shander and Targos looked upon the incredible structure with a confused mixture of awe, appreciation, and terror. They could not resist the unearthly beauty of Kryshal Tirith, but they knew the consequences of the tower's appearance. Akar Kessel, master of goblins and giants, had come. goblins and orcs fell to their knees, and all the vast army took up the chant of Kessel! Kessel! Paying homage to the wizard with a fanatical devotion that brought shivers to the human witnesses to the spectacle. Drizzt, too, was unnerved by the extent of the influence and devotion the wizard exerted over the normally independent goblin tribes. The drow determined at that moment that the only chance for survival for the people of Ten Towns lay in the death of Akkar Kessel. He knew even before he had considered any of the possible options that he would try to get to the wizard. For now, though, he needed to rest. He found a shadowed hole just back from the face of Kelvin's cairn and let his exhaustion overtake him. Cassius was also tired. The spokesman had stayed on the wall throughout the cold night, examining the campsites to determine how much of the natural enmity between the unruly tribes remained. He had seen some minor discord and name-calling, but nothing extreme enough to give him hope that the army would fall apart early into the siege. He couldn't understand how the wizard had achieved such a dramatic unification of the arch-foes. The appearance of the demon and the raising of Kryshal Tirith had shown him the incredible power that Kessel commanded. He had soon drawn the same conclusions as the drow. Unlike Drizzt, though, the spokesman from Bryn Shander did not retire when the field calmed again, despite the protests of Regis and Glen Sather concerned for his health. On his shoulders, Cassius carried the responsibility for the several thousand terrified people that lay huddled within his city's walls, and there would be no rest for him. He needed information. He needed to find a weak link in the wizard's seemingly impregnable armor. And so the spokesman watched diligently and patiently throughout the first long, uneventful day of the siege, noting the boundaries that the goblin tribes staked out as their own, and the order of hierarchy that determined the distance of each group from the center spot of Kryshal Tirith. Away to the east, the fleets of Kaer Konig and Kaer Dinaval moored alongside the docks of the deserted city of Easthaven. Several crews had gone ashore to gather supplies, but most of the people had remained on the boats, unsure of how far east Kessel's black arm extended. Jensen Brent and his counterpart from Kaer Konig had taken full control of their immediate situation from the decks of the Mistseeker, the flagship of Kaer Dinaval. All disputes between the two cities had been called off, temporarily at least, though promises of continued friendship were heard on the decks of every ship on Lac Dinashir. Both spokesmen were agreed that they would not yet leave the waters of the lake and flee, for they realized that they had nowhere to go. All of the Ten Towns were threatened by Kessel, and Luskan was fully 400 miles away and across the path of Kessel's army. The ill-equipped refugees couldn't hope to reach it before the first of winter's snows caught up with them. The sailors that had disembarked soon returned to the docks with the welcome news that Easthaven had not yet been touched by the darkness. More crews were ordered ashore to collect extra food and blankets, but Jensen Brent played it cautiously, thinking it wise to keep most of the refugees out on the water beyond Kessel's reach. More promising news came a short time later.
"Signals from Redwater, Spokesman Brent,"
the watchman atop the Mistseeker's crow's nest called out.
"The people of Goodmead and Dugan's Hole are unharmed."
He held up his newsbearer, a small glass piece crafted in tourmaline and designed to focus the light of the sun for signaling across the lakes, using intricate, though limited, signaling codes.
"My calls have been answered."
"Where are they, then?"
Brent asked excitedly.
"On the eastern banks," the watchman replied. "They sailed out of their villages, thinking them undefendable. None of the monsters have yet approached, but the spokesman felt that the far side of the lake would be safer until the invaders have departed."
"Keep the communication open," Brent ordered. "Let me know when you have more news."
"Until the invaders have departed," Shermont echoed incredulously as he moved to Jensen Brent's side.
"A foolishly hopeful assessment of the situation, I agree," said Brent. "But I am relieved that our cousins to the south yet live."
"Do we go to them? Join our forces?"
"Not yet," answered Brent. "I fear that we would be too vulnerable on the open ground between the lakes. We need more information before we can take any effective action.
Let us keep the communications flowing between the two lakes. Gather volunteers to carry messages to Redwaters.
They shall be sent off immediately, agreed Shermont as he headed away.
Brent nodded and looked back across the lake at the dying plume of smoke above his home.
More information, he muttered to himself.
Other volunteers headed out later that day into the more treacherous west to scout out the situation in the principal city. Brent and Shermont had done a masterful job in quelling the panic, but even with the substantial gains in organization, the initial shock of the sudden and deadly invasion had left most of the survivors of Kaer Konig and Kaer Dinnaval in a state of utter despair. Jensen Brent was the glowing exception. The spokesman from Kaer Dinnaval was a courageous fighter who steadfastly refused to yield until the last breath had left his body. He sailed his proud flagship around the moorings of the others, rallying the people with his cries of promised revenge against Akar Kessel. Now he watched and waited on the Mistseeker for the critical news from the west. In mid-afternoon he heard the call he had prayed for.
"She stands!" the watcher on the crow's nest cried out ecstatically when the newsbearer's signal flashed in. "Bryn Shander stands!"
Suddenly, Brent's optimism took on credibility. The miserable band of homeless victims assumed an angry posture bent on vengeance. More messengers were dispatched at once to carry the news to Redwaters that Kessel hadn't yet achieved complete victory. On both lakes, the task of separating the warriors from the civilians soon began in earnest, with the women and children moving to the heaviest and least seaworthy boats, and the fighting men boarding the fastest vessels. The designated warships were then moved to the outbound moorings, where they could put out quickly across the lakes. Their sails were checked and tightened in preparation for the wild run that would carry their brave crews to war. Or, by Jensen Brent's furious decree, the run that would carry their brave crews to victory! Regis had rejoined Cassius on the wall when the newsbearer's signal had been spotted on the southwestern banks of Lac Dinashir. The halfling had slept for most of the night and day, figuring that he might as well die doing the thing he loved to do best. He was surprised when he awakened, expecting his slumber to last into eternity. Cassius was beginning to view things a bit differently, though. He had compiled a long list of potential breakdowns in Akar Kessel's unruly army, orcs bullying goblins, and giants in turn bullying both. If he could only find a way for them to hold out long enough for the obvious hatred between the goblin races to take its toll on Kessel's force. And then, the signal from Lac Dinashir and subsequent reports of similar flashes on the far side of Redwaters had given the spokesman sincere hope that the siege might well disintegrate and Ten Towns survive. But then the wizard made his dramatic appearance, and Cassius's hopes were dashed. It began as a pulse of red light circling within the glassy wall at the base of Kryshal Tirith. Then a second pulse, this one blue, started up the tower, rotating in the opposite direction. Slowly they circled the diameter of the tower, blending into green as they converged, then separating and continuing on their way. All who could see the tantalizing show stared apprehensively, unsure of what would happen next, but convinced that a display of tremendous power was forthcoming. The circling lights speeded up, their intensity increasing with their velocity. Soon the entire base of the tower was ringed in a green blur, so bright that the onlookers had to avert their eyes. And out of the blur stepped two hideous trolls, each bearing an ornate mirror. The light slowed and stopped altogether. The mere sight of the disgusting trolls filled the people of Bryn Shander with revulsion, but intrigued, no one would turn away. The monsters walked right to the base of the city's sloping hill and stood facing each other, aiming their mirrors diagonally toward each other, but still catching the reflection of Kryshal Tirith. Twin beams of light shot down from the tower, each one striking one of the mirrors and converging with the other halfway between the trolls. A sudden pulse from the tower, like the flash of a lightning stroke, left the area between the monsters veiled in smoke, and when it cleared, instead of the converging beams of light, stood a thin, crooked shell of a man in a red, satiny robe. Goblins fell to their knees again and hid their faces in the ground. Akar Kessel had come. He looked up in the direction of Cassius on the wall, a cocky smile stretched across his thin lips.
"Greetings, spokesman of Bryn Shander," he cackled. "Welcome to my fair city," he laughed wryly.
Cassius had no doubt that the wizard had picked him out, though he had no recollection of ever seeing the man and didn't understand how he had been recognized. He looked to Regis and Glenn Sather for an explanation, but they both shrugged their shoulders.
"Yes, I know you, Cassius," Cassel said. "And to you, good spokesman Glenn Sather, my greetings. I should have guessed that you would be here. Ever were the people of Easthaven willing to join in a cause, no matter how hopeless."
Now it was Glenn Sather's turn to stare dumbfounded at his companions. But again, there were no explanations forthcoming.
"You know of us," Cassius replied to the apparition. "Yet you are unknown to us. It seems that you hold an unfair advantage."
"Unfair?" protested the wizard. "I hold every advantage, foolish man."
Again the laugh.
"You know of me. At least Glenn Sather does."
The spokesman from Easthaven shrugged his shoulders again in reply to Cassius's inquiring glance. The gesture seemed to anger Kessel.
"I spent several months living in Easthaven," the wizard snapped, "in the guise of a wizard's apprentice from Luskin. Clever, don't you agree?"
"Do you remember him?" Cassius asked Glenn Sather softly. "It could be of great import."
"It is possible that he stayed in Easthaven," Glenn Sather replied in the same whispered tones, "though no group from the Host Tower has come into my city for several years. Yet we are an open city, and many foreigners arrive with every passing trading caravan. I tell you the truth, Cassius, I have no recollection of the man."
Kessel was outraged. He stamped his foot impatiently, and the smile on his face was replaced by a pouting pucker.
"Perhaps my return to Ten Towns will prove more memorable, fools," he snapped.
He held his arms outstretched in self-important proclamation.
"Behold, Akar Kessel, the tyrant of Icewind Dale," he cried. "People of Ten Towns, your master has come."
"Your words are a bit premature,"
Cassius began, but Kessel cut him short with a frenzied scream.
"Never interrupt me!"
the wizard shouted, the veins in his neck taut and bulging, and his face turning as red as blood. Then, as Cassius quieted in disbelief, Kessel seemed to regain a measure of his composure.
"You shall learn better, proud Cassius," he threatened. "You shall learn!"
He turned back to Kryshal Tirith and uttered a simple word of command. The tower went black for a moment, as though it refused to release the reflections of the sun's light. Then it began to glow far within its depths, with a light that seemed more its own than a reflection of the day. With each passing second, the hue shifted, and the light began to climb and circle the strange walls.
"Behold, Akar Kessel!" the wizard proclaimed, still frowning. "Look upon the splendor of Kren Shinabon and surrender all hope."
More lights began flashing within the tower's walls, climbing and dropping randomly, and spinning about the structure in a frenzied dance that cried out for release. Gradually, they were working their way up to the pointed pinnacle, and it began to flare as if on fire, shifting through the colors of the spectrum until its white flame rivaled the brightness of the sun itself. Kessel cried out as a man in ecstasy. The fire was released. It shot out in a thin, searing line northward toward the unfortunate city of Targos. Many spectators lined Targos' high wall, though the tower was much farther away from them than it was from Bryn Shander, and it appeared as no more than a flashing speck on the distant plain. They had little idea of what was happening beneath the principal city, though they did see the ray of fire coming toward them. But by then, it was too late. The wrath of Akar Kessel roared into the proud city, cutting a swath of instant devastation. Fires sprouted all along its killing line. People caught in the direct path never even had a chance to cry out before they were simply vaporized. But those who survived the initial attack, women and children and tundra-toughened men alike, who had faced death a thousand times and more, did scream. and their wails carried out across the still lake to Lonelywood in Bremen, to the cheering goblins in Tourmaline, and down the plain to the horrified witnesses in Bryn Shander. Kessel waved his hand and slightly altered the angle of the release, thus arcing the destruction throughout Targos. Every major structure within the city was soon burning, and hundreds of people lay dead or dying, pitifully rolling about on the ground to extinguish the flames that engulfed their bodies, or gasping helplessly in a desperate search for air in the heavy smoke. Kessel reveled in the moment. But then he felt an involuntary shudder rack his spine, and the tower too seemed to quiver. The wizard clutched at the relic, still tucked under the folds of his robe. He understood that he had pushed the limits of Crenshinabon's strength too far. Back in the spine of the world, the first tower that Kessel had raised crumbled into rubble, and far out on the open tundra, the second did likewise. The shard pulled in its borders, destroying the tower images that sapped away its strength. Kessel, too, had been wearied by the effort, and the lights of the remaining Kryshel Tirith began to calm and then to wane. The ray fluttered and died. But it had finished its business. When the invasion had first come, Kemp and the other proud leaders of Targos had promised their people that they would hold the city until the last man had fallen. But even the stubborn spokesman realized that they had no choice but to flee. Luckily, the city proper, which had taken the brunt of Kessel's attack, was on high ground overlooking the sheltered bay area. The fleets remained unharmed, and the homeless fishermen of Tourmaline were already on the docks, having stayed with their boats after they had docked in Targos. As soon as they had realized the unbelievable extent of the destruction that was occurring in the city proper, they began preparing for the imminent influx of the war's latest refugees. Most of the boats of both cities sailed out within minutes of the attack, desperate to get their vulnerable sails safely away from the wind-blown sparks and debris. A few vessels remained behind, braving the growing hazards to rescue any later arrivals on the docks. The people on Bryn Shander's dock wept at the continued screams of the dying. Cassius, though, consumed by his quest to seek out and understand the apparent weaknesses that Kessel had just revealed, had no time for tears. In truth, the cries affected him as deeply as anyone, but unwilling to let the lunatic Kessel view any hints of weakness from him, he transformed his visage from sorrow to an iron grimace of rage. Kessel laughed at him.
"Do not pout, poor Cassius," the wizard taunted. "It is unbecoming." "You are a dog," Glenn Sather retorted, "and unruly dogs should be beaten."
Cassius stayed his fellow spokesman with an outstretched hand.
"Be calm, my friend," he whispered. "Kessel will feed off of our panic. Let him talk. He reveals more to us than he believes."
"Poor Cassius,"
Kessel repeated sarcastically. Then suddenly, the wizard's face twisted in outrage. Cassius noted the abrupt swing keenly, filing it away with the other information he had collected.